Peter B. Collins News and Comment, with more than 1,500 podcasts served to date. Here's my latest coverage. News and Comment are the top stories of the day.
We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace.
Swiftly executing his plan to support the Assad government in Syria, Vladimir Putin got approval from the Russian parliament and begun airstrikes in Syria today. Now, it's interesting because the New York Times notes that last part, thusly. The attacks were unleashed hours after Putin pushed a measure through the upper house of Russia's rubber-stamped parliament, authorizing the use of force abroad. And while I do not welcome Russia joining the, clusterfuck in Syria, that is spinning out of control. France started bombing this week. Turkey's in the act. The U.S.-led so-called coalition. Bombers from the Emirates were there before. I don't know if they are still conducting raids. But this is a huge mess. The difference is that Putin actually got his legislature to authorize the action that he's taking. And certainly it is a rubber stamp parliament. I don't dispute that for a moment. But our do-nothing Congress has failed to provide any legal basis for the U.S. operations in Syria and Iraq that have been going on for more than a year. And the War Powers Act gives 90 days for Congress to act when the president begins hostilities. And so, once again, Vladimir Putin is operating in a manner that leaves the United States in the dust. Not only strategically as it relates to this mess in Syria, but in terms of, you know, operating nominally within the law. So the U.S. is now concerned because the initial targets of Russian airstrikes in Syria don't include anything connected to the Islamic State. And the reports indicate that what's left of the Free Syrian Army, this hodgepodge of people that we've been supporting, was actually bearing the brunt of this attack near the city of Homs. Now, the U.S. got an hour's alert that was passed through the Iraqi government by a 3-star Russian general that Russia was going to begin these flights. So it's extremely complicated, and one of the concerns that's very fundamental is, will these different military units from France, the U.S., Russia, Turkey, will they avoid hitting each other, either accidentally or accidentally on purpose? And what happens when we conduct airstrikes? So far, we have not, to my knowledge, used our air power directly against Assad's military forces. But our twin goals are to get rid of Assad and get rid of the Islamic State, as incoherent as that strategy is. And so this is going to be a very dicey, delicate situation for some time to come. And trying to persuade Russia to operate according to the U.S. playbook is something that Obama attempted in his speech and then in his one-on-one with Putin at the United Nations on Monday. But get this quote from John Kerry. He says, "The United States would have grave concerns if the Russians bomb other moderate rebel groups besides the Islamic State and al-Nusra, the group linked to al-Qaeda." Now, keep in mind that those so-called moderate rebel groups aren't that moderate, and many of them get their funding from Saudi Arabia, from the Emirates, and who knows elsewhere. So this struggle over whether Assad has to go before The Islamic State is presumably vanquished, or if it should be in the reverse order, is a fundamental difference between the U.S. and Russia in this conflict where we are nominally allies? I don't know. I mean, we're kind of on the same side to the extent that Russia says it's going after the Islamic State, but we're clearly not on the same side when it comes to the issues of Assad. John Kerry went on in a different quote here to say that the Islamic State cannot be defeated as long as Assad is in power. Huh? I don't understand that. And I think it's bullshit. And John Kerry knows it. But he is boxed in by the policies and lack of policy of the United States. Meanwhile, as you know, last December we held ceremonies that depicted our military departure from Afghanistan, the end of combat operations, it was called. But in the last couple of days, U.S. air power has been directed on the Afghan city of Kunduz, which was taken a couple of days ago by the Taliban. That was on Monday. And the Kabul government says, we're on our way. We're going to take Kunduz back. And so they called for American airstrike to support the Afghan ground troops. The problem is the Afghan ground troops are bogged down in the town of Baglan, where Taliban forces have tied them up and prevented them from getting to Kunduz. And just to add a little, you know, verite to this, two units of the Afghan local police surrendered their bases just outside the town of Pul-e-Kumri to the Taliban on Wednesday and joined them, while a third base was overrun. And these are the Afghan forces that we trained at great expense, in cash, and in some American lives. And they cannot, they will not stand and fight. And they're unlikely to prevail in this renewed conflict with the Taliban. And, of course, you know, they only fight seasonally in Afghanistan. Winter is coming. And at some point, the gains of the Taliban will probably be secured by the weather. And once again, the idea that American airstrikes alone can change the dynamics on the ground, well, it's pure folly. Now, I have this from an unusual source, and I want to make clear that this is the only source that has reported this particular story. But as you hear it, you'll understand. It relates to the group Anonymous. And they've announced that they have been attacking the Saudi government. And their motivation is that Saudi Arabia's high court last week upheld a decision to crucify and then behead a young man who was 17 years old when he was arrested in 2012 during the Arab Spring. His offense is that he used his BlackBerry to encourage others to join a protest against the Saudi royal family's authoritarian government. His name is Ali Mohammed Al-Nimr, last name spelled N-I-M-R. He also claims that he's been falsely accused of having a gun. He said he's never had a gun. And that the weapon accusation has been used to justify the harsh punishment that is proposed. Now, I have not heard of a crucifixion in modern times at all. We know that the Saudi government regularly beheads people it convicts of crimes, and they've had so many decapitations, they had to hire an extra executioner. And, of course, the U.S. never objects to these barbaric actions by our nominal ally, but of course when the Islamic State beheads people for video propaganda, our selective outrage kicks into high gear. And the influence of Saudi Arabia is still being felt in American courts, where a district judge on Tuesday threw out the claims by family members of 9/11 victims who had sued the nation of Saudi Arabia and other entities, including their High Commission for Relief, seeking money damages for Saudi Arabia's role in the events of September 11th, 2001. And the cover-up continues to hold. We know that if Senator Bob Graham had his way, we would be able to see a fully unredacted 28-page memo that he says shows that Saudi Arabia directly financed the attacks of September 11th. But the district court judge, George Daniels, claimed that Saudi Arabia's sovereign immunity exempts it from such a lawsuit unless the evidence showed that Saudi Arabia or its officials took actions to support the terrorist plot. So we've got this beautiful catch-22. The memo Bob Graham once released would provide the legal basis for this lawsuit to proceed, and it might expose the role of the Saudi government. But you keep the memo locked up, and you can keep things locked up in the courts as well. Every day I like to pause for a moment and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. And today I want to mention a few folks like Gunnar Gunderson. Last time I heard, he's living in Saudi Arabia. And he's a big booster of the PBC podcast with more than one subscription. Thank you, Gunnar. Sharon Gadberry's a monthly subscriber, along with Linda Gray and Casita Kojo Amenya. I'd like to invite you to join their ranks. If you've never heard your name, maybe it means you need to take out a subscription, he said, with a nudge. Come on over. Just click on the link on the upper right-hand corner of my newly designed, redesigned website, and the pull-down will lead you to take out a subscription, and there you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers, well, you get a copy of Pepe Escobar's latest ebook called Empire of Chaos and My Deep Gratitude. And today, for our subscribers, I'm releasing a new in-depth interview with Robert Perry. Bob Perry is a longtime Washington-based journalist. He worked for the Associated Press, for Newsweek, for the PBS NewsHour, and he's been independently publishing at Consortium News for more than 20 years. And I think he's a brilliant guy who provides important history and context to current issues. And in our conversation, he expands on his recent article, commentary, where he exposes President Obama's false narratives on Syria and Ukraine. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Bob Perry.
So we came very close to turning Syria over to major terrorist organizations because there really was no moderate rebel opposition.
Really?
That was sort of the myth that they also was created, was there was these moderate rebels who never seemed to exist in any significant numbers, and whenever the U.S. would train a bunch, they would immediately turn themselves over to joining Nusra or joining the Islamic States. But the person who sort of helped Obama avoid that disastrous decision that was almost made in Washington back in summer of 2013 was Vladimir Putin,
right?
The president of Russia. He got in there and helped negotiate an agreement with Assad, where Assad said, I had nothing to do with the sarin attacks, but I will surrender all my chemical weapons. And he did. So you had this. So at that point, the neoconservatives and the liberal interventionists who were so hot to bomb Assad's military in Syria and have regime change, which they've wanted for years now, they, in a sense, turned their fury against Putin. And we see in the summer, late summer of 2013, neoconservative writings about we have to turn to Ukraine. We have to, as Ukraine was the biggest prize, according to NED President Gershman. And then he went on to say, and this is a stepping stone, really, to get to regime change in Moscow. So the idea was to just continue expanding this idea of regime change in place after place. And so we ended up with then in early 2014, this civil war being started in Ukraine, a new Cold War essentially being created with Russia. But throughout this, there's been this overlay of propaganda that has prevented the American people from understanding what on earth is going on here.
You can hear the full interview with Robert Perry. It's available today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com, at iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, all of the places where you find my podcasts. You know, I went to Northwestern University and I started my radio career in Chicago when Nixon was president. And Chicago's always been a dangerous place, but this year has been particularly deadly. And just in the last overnight period, during a 15-hour stretch, 14 people were shot in Chicago and 6 of them died. And this follows 2 consecutive weekends when more than 50 people were shot in the city each weekend. And Monday night, it included the wounding of an 11-month-old child, which left his mother and grandmother dead. One of the incidents occurred near midnight at a barbecue that was to honor a person who had died in a car crash 12 years earlier. I can't imagine how that altercation began. And Rahm Emanuel is calling for tighter gun regulations. But frankly, this is a case where I think people need to look inside. I support reasonable gun control. But I think we have to look at the social factors and the human beings who choose to settle their disputes with bullets. The Senate has done its job passing what's called a clean spending bill, these authorizations for different government agencies that are rolled up in one continuing resolution. Now the House will take it up, and they will probably pass it without any effort to defund Planned Parenthood, but there will be attempted amendments and a lot of pandering, mostly by right-wing Republicans. But as we speak to you here, it's about 2 p.m. Pacific time here on the last day of September, it does appear that a government shutdown has been avoided. But the battle over Planned Parenthood, which reached a skirmish at a House committee yesterday, is going to continue. And it's gotten really ugly. I mean, if you saw some of the clips of Congressman Jason Chaffetz, the Republican from Utah who chairs the Oversight Committee, and how rude he was to Cecile Richards, the president of Planned Parenthood, who was attempting to answer the questions that he was peppering his narrative with. But each time she tried to answer, he would just mow her down, just talk over her. And at one point she said, "Would the chairman yield?" Which is a polite parliamentary expression. And usually the answer is yes. But Jason Chaffetz just said no. And he exposed himself as a demagogue. And near the end of his presentation, which he was jamming into a particular time limit, Jason Chaffetz really blundered, and Cecile Richards called him out on it, because he posted a chart, a graphic, that was incredibly misleading. It was comparing apples and oranges, and it had an arrow going up and to the right that showed the number of abortions performed by Planned Parenthood clinics. And it showed a number declining and going to the right, which they said was cancer screenings conducted by Planned Parenthood. And Jason Chaffetz did this whole thing about his mother had died of breast cancer, and his father died of cancer too, and therefore he was appalled that we're killing babies instead of fighting cancer. Now this is the, I was going to say height, but it's the depth of disingenuousness. And that's what this whole attack on Planned Parenthood is based on, disingenuousness, starting with the contrived videos that purport to expose Planned Parenthood as selling baby parts, when in fact the parts are donated by the mothers who agree to an abortion. And Planned Parenthood has picked up some nominal fees, reimbursements for handling the tissue. But that doesn't stop the demagogues. Their real goal is to shut down Planned Parenthood over the 3% of its budget that funds abortion services. And they made that very clear. And when Cecile Richards, after one of her lawyers had whispered in her ear, pointed out that the chart Jason Chaffetz was using had been supplied by the anti-abortion group that made the contrived videos. Well, his time was up, and he was silenced and flummoxed. Yesterday, I reported to you that the state of Missouri Attorney General conducted an investigation of Planned Parenthood of Missouri and cleared them of any wrongdoing in the handling of fetal tissue. But a victory for pro-birth activists in Missouri has been achieved nonetheless, because the state Senate leader, Kurt Schaefer, a Republican, created and appointed himself chair of the Senate Sanctity of Life Committee. And he hammered the University of Missouri, Mizzou as they call it, in Columbia, to deny access or referral privileges to a doctor who is the only woman, the only physician who was conducting abortions at the Columbia Planned Parenthood Clinic. And like many other states, they've passed these pretextual laws. They say it's to protect the patients in abortion clinics, saying that you can't have a clinic if you don't have referral privileges at a local hospital. Then what they do is, without banning abortion, they shut down a clinic and block access to abortion for women in that community by denying the hospital referral privileges to the doctors who perform abortions. This has been done in Texas and replicated around the country. And so this state senator pressured the University of Missouri, and the executive committee voted unanimously to discontinue refer and follow as a category of privileges at their health care facilities. It's the backdoor way to ban abortion. And I'm sorry to say, it is working. We are losing ground every day on the right to choose in this country. Lemony Snicket and his wife, actual names Daniel Handler and Lisa Brown, have announced they're donating $1 million to Planned Parenthood from the profits of their children's books. And I got an email from the so-called Traditional Values Coalition, which really exposes the disingenuous and the compounded lies that are used to feed and pander to the religious right and to get them to contribute money. This email reads, Planned Parenthood has committed over 61 million abortions, 61 million babies, and receives hundreds of millions of dollars in federal tax funding, money you and I pay so that Planned Parenthood can continue its grisly and ghoulish business of trafficking in baby body parts. All right, number one, the 61 million number may be accurate, but they're not babies. Number two, the linkage of hundreds of millions of dollars in federal tax funding to abortions is completely false. Not a dime of federal money is used for abortion services at Planned Parenthood or anywhere else. And then the third lie is that the money will allow Planned Parenthood to continue its grisly and ghoulish business of trafficking in baby body parts. It's flatly false, but it's an argument that works on the people who want to believe it. And there are far too many Americans who fall into that category. I want to thank listener Linda Lewis for a tip on Facebook to this article at the Philadelphia newspaper, philly.com. And it's written by a law professor named David Cohen at the Drexel University School of Law. And he points out that the efforts by Republicans to defund Planned Parenthood are flatly unconstitutional, because the effort is a bill of attainder. And our Constitution flatly prohibits that. A bill of attainder is a law that inflicts punishment on a particular individual without a judicial trial. And I'll link to this commentary so you can read it for yourself. But he says the actions meet the definition of a bill of attainder and its requirements. The law has to determine guilt and inflict punishment. It must act upon an identifiable individual or group, and it must do so without provision of the protections of a judicial trial. And the law professor argues that all of those requirements are met in this case. But that doesn't matter. They know they're never actually going to defund Planned Parenthood. It's all a shell game to pander to the hardline right-wing voters in Republican primaries and in the gerrymandered House districts. And it is very effective. You know who Kim Davis is. She's the four times married woman who is the clerk of a county in Kentucky. She has refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, claiming a religious freedom exemption. And now we have learned that she had a kind of secret meeting with Pope Francis in Washington last week. Now, it's not really secret now. The Vatican has admitted that it happened. They said they just didn't want the publicity at the time to distract from the big messages that Francis was pushing. And I have to say that while I disagree with the Pope and Kim Davis on the issue of same-sex marriage licenses, the Pope is arguing that his position in supporting Kim Davis is that he supports conscientious objection. And on that narrow question, I support Kim Davis and the Pope, because I was a conscientious objector to the Selective Service draft system during the Vietnam War. And while I've heard many people denounce Kim Davis, and I don't find her likable, and I don't particularly support her position, I think she is entitled to refuse to issue those licenses. She should be fired from her job immediately. And they did lock her up for contempt for a few days. It remains to be seen what will happen next. But again, I will say that I do believe that people of conscience can refuse to perform certain duties, functions, or obligations. But as any other act of civil disobedience, that individual must accept the consequences, the secular consequences, of their actions. Well, a group of states that are determined to execute capital criminals are engaged in interstate trafficking in deadly illegal drugs. Yesterday's execution did go forward late last night or early this morning in Georgia, where Kelly Gissendaner was ultimately executed. Richard Glossop is scheduled to be killed in Oklahoma today. And there is a case in Virginia where Alfredo Prieto is scheduled to be executed, but a stay has been issued because of a challenge over where the drugs to kill him came from. And Virginia has acknowledged that it got a dose of phenobarbital from the state of Texas. And Texas disclosed to Virginia where it got the drugs from some compounding pharmacy, but they don't want to name that pharmacy because, well, it's considered illegal and unethical to make drugs that kill people. And so the death machinery is stalled these days by people who have a conscience. Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic governor of Virginia, wants the execution to go forward. He has rejected calls for clemency. And driven by the recent Supreme Court decision that just said, we don't care how you kill these people or if they suffer, just kill them. Well, that's what's going on in our country today. Senator Elizabeth Warren has claimed a new scalp. A guy named Robert Lytton or Lytton has just resigned from the Brookings Institution, because this summer he went up to Capitol Hill and testified in favor of a report that criticized the Labor Department's plan to regulate brokerages. And this is something Warren cares about. It's part of the Dodd-Frank bill. And Warren was concerned that a study that Lytton presented, which he represented that he and his co-author were the sole authors of, was actually not produced by the Brookings Institution, but by a for-profit consulting firm called Economist Incorporated. And Litton got $38,000 for his role in preparing this study. The total tab was $85,000. But he was not honest. He didn't fully disclose the connections about this report. And Elizabeth Warren sniffed it out. And Strobe Talbott, the former Time magazine editor and writer who runs the Brookings Institution, called for the resignation and received it. And finally today, I want to thank another listener for tipping me to this important story I'm about to share with you. And that would be Carl Howard in Columbus, Ohio. He pointed me to The Intercept and Glenn Greenwald's brilliant piece, which I'm linking to in the show file for today's podcast, which fingers my senior senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, and her powerful, wealthy husband, Dick Blum, in an effort to silence students and professors at the University of California who criticize Israel. And this is a really dirty, unconstitutional violation of the First Amendment and an effort to create a double standard where criticism of Israel is redefined as anti-Semitism. And this is something that's been going on for a while. It's partly a reaction to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement that is gaining ground. But Dick Blum really crossed the line, because he is a member of the Board of Regents, which is the trustees of the University of California system. And they have been working on rules that would allow the suspension or expulsion of students or professors who violate this unconstitutional prohibition on free speech about Israel. So at a recent Regents meeting, Dick Blum said, "Over the weekend, my wife, your senior senator," as if that's lost on them, "and I talked about this issue at length. She wants to stay out of the conversation publicly, but if we do not do the right thing," this is a threat, "she will engage publicly and is prepared to be critical of this university if we don't have the kind of not only statement but penalties for those who commit what you can call them crimes, call them whatever you want. Students that do the things that have been cited here today probably ought to have a dismissal or a suspension from school. I don't know how many of you feel strongly that way, but my wife does, and so do I." So Dick Blum, not content to use his own swagger and power as an individual, has to invoke the threat of his power wife, the senator, to press for an unconstitutional restriction on speech. And Greenwald analyzed this very deftly. He says, "How does speech about Israel become anti-Semitism? Well, according to a State Department definition, anti-Semitism includes those who demonize Israel by drawing comparisons of contemporary Israeli policy to that of the Nazis, or blaming Israel for all interreligious or political tensions. 2, espouse a double standard for Israel by requiring of it a behavior not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation. Or 3, to delegitimize Israel by denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination and denying Israel the right to exist." And Greenwald says the ironies of this definition are overwhelming. And he breaks it down and takes it apart. And I hope you'll read Greenwald's treatise, because it's a little long, about 14 pages. But it is extremely powerful and right on the mark. And I've dealt with this for many years. I've long criticized the government of the State of Israel. But I'm always careful not to criticize Jewish people in general, or even Jews who are running the State of Israel. I talk about Israelis, I don't talk about Jews. And I'm recognizing that there's a certain amount of self-censorship that I engage in order to navigate these tricky waters. And when I was on local radio in San Francisco, when I spoke up for the rights of Palestinians, I was attacked by the Anti-Defamation League. They went to the management. They made me sit through meetings with ADL lawyers. and I never changed my posture or changed my expression. But their efforts to chill free speech, to silence those who are critical of the policies of the state of Israel, is so un-American and so unconstitutional, it is outrageous. Let me quote from Glenn Greenwald. The effort to formally redefine anti-Semitism to include certain criticisms of and activism against the Israeli government has been coordinated and deliberate. The history is laid out with ample evidence here by the nonprofit group Palestine Legal. Oh, that's a book he's linking to. And here, another link, by Ali Abunuma's book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. And other articles by Glenn Greenwald are linked as well. In essence, this redefinition was first promulgated by Israeli lobbyists and academics, imposed with varying degrees of success in the European Union, and then successfully imported into the Clinton-led State Department. Well, this is a very important issue. And the state of California has been caving. The legislature has passed resolutions supporting this double standard and the punishment of people who speak critically of Israel and its policies. And I join Glenn Greenwald in denouncing this kind of demagoguery. We got to continue to fight it. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you're free to share with absolutely everyone. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.